Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2012, the University of Chicago put together a panel of 41 of the world's top economists, and they all agreed that the benefits of free trade outweigh the costs. President Obama said last week that globalization is here and done. But many are pushing back across the political spectrum, from Trump to Sanders, and across the ocean, from the U.S. to Brexit to growing nationalism and protectionism around Europe. Our globalized world that brought us Walmart bargains and interconnected us while moving manufacturing jobs overseas is under harsh scrutiny. Development economist Jeffrey Sachs says we've done it wrong. This hour On Point, Jeffrey Sachs on the problems of globalization as we've pursued it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you feel like a winner or a loser in globalization? Do we need a course correction? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last week, meeting with leaders of Mexico and Canada in Ottawa, Canada, President Obama defended free trade and globalization. It's done.
The integration of national economies into a global economy, that's here. That's done. And so the question is not whether or not there's going to be a international global economy. There is one.
There is one. It's here. It's done. Jeffrey Sachs says we need to talk about how it's been done. He's professor of economics and sustainable development at Columbia University, also director of the Center for Sustainable Development there, special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on sustainable development goals. He was also a big supporter of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary for president. Jeffrey Sachs, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Tom, great to be with you. Thank you.
Your recent essay caught our eye. We wanted to talk about it. You say a lot of people, about half the population, are rejecting globalization as currently implemented, your phrase there. To quote you, you say they believe that immigration is out of control, culturally destabilizing, adverse to their economic interests. They believe that the political and financial elites have joined forces to abuse power, evade taxes, and twist globalization toward narrow ends. And you write, then, these attitudes are not racist, xenophobic, or fascist. They are based on facts on the ground. You're all on board, Jeffrey Sachs?
The fact is we have serious problems. And in the United States, a big majority of the citizens feel that we're on the wrong track. A big part of that is the feeling that income inequality has widened very significantly. There are a lot of people that have been left behind in all of the changes of recent decades. And what we have here, especially with, I would say, Donald Trump's anti-immigrant and populist campaign, is really being seen also all across Europe. Brexit is the same phenomenon, but it's not only the UK vote. It's the 50-50 election, which is now in a rerun in Austria. Almost exactly the same issues. It's political parties all across Europe that are arguing against migration and are saying things are not working right. They're all reflecting this same feeling of anxiety, which is hitting a lot of the society. Now, what's absolutely true also is that the elites in the U.S. and Europe have done splendidly in the last 30 or 40 years. So they don't get it. They don't get what this backlash is about. Are you kidding? Why don't you love what's happening? And they're not feeling it. And our political system basically has stopped looking at what happens below the top for a long time. And people in the U.S. feel that way, and they feel that way in other high-income countries that are sharing that phenomenon.
Let's sort this out. You've worked on the global stage for a long time in development, economic development. Are you, Jeffrey Sachs, anti-globalization.
No. And in fact, a lot of my writings for the first 15, 20 years of my professional career as an economist, especially at the time I was at Harvard, were about the benefits of globalization. But there's a basic idea in economics, which President Obama did not make clear in his statement, that's here, that's done, and that the 41 economists that you mentioned at University of Chicago could not capture by the statement that the benefits outweigh the costs. The idea of benefits from trade, which goes back more than 200 years, goes back to Adam Smith and David Ricardo, is that trade increases the size of the economic pie, but it also changes the division of the pie. So there can be losers as well as winners. And the real claim about trade is that the winners could compensate the losers so that everybody's better off. But unless that kind of compensation takes place, losers are losers, and they're annoyed if the benefits are going too much to capital or too much to the elites or too much to the high-skilled workers and taking the jobs away from the low-skilled workers. So when you say, or when one says benefits outweigh the costs, you have to say benefits for whom, costs for whom, and is it enough to outweigh the costs, or should those who are incurring net costs be helped out? And in our country,
incurring net costs, fancy language for being laid off or out of a job.
It means
or
your wage is cut. You're told, look, if you want to keep your job, but you're competing now against workers in China or in Mexico, and we're lowering your wage or not giving you a raise for 5-10 years. And that's just how life is. But the fact of the matter is, yes, our economy has expanded and globalization has helped to do it, but it's become notoriously recognized now as a notorious fact that the benefits have gone overwhelmingly to the top, and our political system simply stopped addressing the issues of those even in the middle, much less the bottom. We turned to a kind of so-called libertarian approach, which is you're on your own, buddy. And the people who have been told that, who are on the losing side of the bargain, really don't like it.
Here's the way that was put the day after the Brexit vote in the UK, where, of course, Brexit won. Britain on track now to leave the European Union. Here was the UK Independence Party leader Nigel Farage, thrilled with it, said it was UK's Independence Day.
It's a victory for ordinary people, decent people. It's a victory against the big merchant banks, against the big businesses, and against big politics. And I'm proud of everybody that had the courage, in the face of all the threats, everything they were told, they had the guts to stand up and do the right thing.
Economist Jeffrey Sachs is with us. Jeffrey Sachs, are you so sure that people are standing up and doing the right thing? You say that the attitudes that have generated opposition to globalization are not racist, not xenophobic, not fascist. Are you so sure?
Yeah, I am sure that when we have a peak of inequality in our modern history, as we have in the United States, when we have a political system which just doesn't care about even the so-called median voter, again, much less those at the bottom, when we have elites that just can't hear but only mock this attitude, when you even take the train, as I often do, Amtrak from Boston to Washington or New York to Washington, and you see the number of hollowed out cities along the Amtrak Northeast Corridor, you know that there's a real issue here. But we stopped in this country investing in infrastructure. We've cut back job skill training. We have our budget cuts and our sequestrations and our domestic spending caps and our tax cuts for the rich and our rising inequality. And so in this sense, the second part of the deal of trade, which is we're going to go for trade, we're going to expand the pie, and we're going to bring everyone along, has not been fulfilled. But there is, Tom, I think, another point that really is even more complicated and that is also part of the scene that we should reflect on.
Good.
And that is that in addition to the winners and losers economically, there just is a perception in the U.S. and Europe by a lot of people that the rate of immigration, this is not trade in goods and services or offshoring of jobs, but the number of people coming in has been so large and so little controlled that our cultures and our society have changed, and a lot of people don't like that also. And of course, one needs to really think hard about that. In the U.S., we had reached a pretty low level of foreign-born in the population by 1965 because our immigration laws were changed in the 20s. Mm-hmm. That restricted immigration. We became
pretty much native-born. 4.8% foreign-born in 1970, you report.
Exactly. And we became pretty much native-born. And then there was a surge after the 1965 immigration law, especially of Hispanic population. We're now about 14% foreign-born. That's a surge of about 59 million people coming into the country. And that has absolutely changed society. And for a lot of people, in addition to the loss of jobs from trade, technology, and so forth, this is a very strong aggravator. When you look at Europe, it's, of course, not the Hispanic migration. It's the migration from their near neighborhood, from Africa, North Africa, the Middle East.
And Europe.
Western Asia. And within Europe, from east to west.
Mm-hmm.
And in the UK, which had this now famous Brexit vote, their share of native-born almost matches the U.S., essentially a tripling from about 5% in 1970 to nearly 15% now. And clearly, Nigel Farage, who we just heard mm-hmm. of UKIP, is really riffing on that. What I've noticed, not so hard to notice, by the way, because it's the number one politics in Europe. I've been traveling all over Europe in recent months. Even in places that really do take care of the poor and those left behind, the social democracies of Northern Europe, even in those places, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, the anti-immigrant concern is very powerful. So it's really both of these phenomena that are playing on top of each other.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the pushback now on globalization with big development guru Jeffrey Sachs. He's a global guy who says a lot of the pushback is justified, that globalization has been carelessly, sometimes cruelly done, thoughtlessly implemented. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Did we get it wrong? Did we do it wrong? Has globalization served too few and ignored big problems? Is Jeffrey Sachs right that a lot of critical attitudes on globalization are not racist, xenophobic, fascist? That they're right? Do we need to tighten borders, spread the fruit around? Jeffrey Sachs is a professor of economics and sustainable development at Columbia University these days. You can hear an echo of what we heard all over the UK. Well, you can hear it all over. Here was Donald Trump last week, speech attacking trade and globalization in Pennsylvania.
The people who rigged the system are supporting Hillary Clinton because they know as long as she is in charge, nothing's going to change. The inner cities will remain poor. The factories will remain closed. The borders will remain open. Our friends in Britain recently voted to take back control of their economy, politics, and borders.
Donald Trump, take back control. He's the Republican candidate for president. It's not only on that side of the political ledger. Here's billionaire George Soros last week. Of course, he's a big contributor to Democrats in this country, progressive issues around the world. He said the EU's got to respond urgently to what he called an existential threat in the refugee crisis now, speaking of borders.
The refugee crisis poses an existential threat to Europe. As I said before, it's the height of irresponsibility to allow the EU to disintegrate without utilizing all its resources.
Progressive billionaire George Soros saying, get in there and work on this. Spend money if you have to, but fix this existential threat. Jeffrey Sachs, can you describe for us, I mean, this is, in some ways, it strikes me as rich to hear you making this argument. I know you've been with Bernie Sanders we've all had an evolution in our understanding of how things work, but I associate you with the early years of globalization when there was so much talk about free trade. And I wonder if you could just share with us how your own thinking has changed on this.
Well, I knew from the first days of my training, as I said earlier, because it's absolutely at the essence of what you learn if you take at least 2 days of economics. Mm-hmm. The first day is the pie will get bigger. The second day is to ensure that everybody's better off. There has to be some redistribution. There has to be some help for the losers. And when I came into economics, which was 44 years ago in 1972 as a student at Harvard College, we had a society where it was at least taken rhetorically that, of course, there was help for the poor. We had just had a war on poverty and so on. And what I've learned over time is not to change my views about whether globalization does or doesn't increase the pie, because I still believe in an interconnected world. But what I've watched really since 1980 is our country losing it in terms of that sense of solidarity. We were told government's the problem, so don't rely on government. We were told you're on your own. We were told that the poor are moochers. If you're a loser, you're a loser. That's the Ayn Rand philosophy. And that became the dominant riff of the elites. And that's a shame because even when it wasn't the dominant riff, by the way, it was the underlying fiscal reality, because we kept cutting the domestic budget, especially what we call the discretionary budget, down to almost nothing in our country now. So things like education, community development, housing, these have come down to almost nothing in our federal spending. So losers lose. And that's what I've seen happen. And it's been a shock for me over the years and a real disappointment that starting with the Reagan Revolution, so-called, it didn't really change during the Clinton years or the Obama years. And even aside from what they may have wanted to do or couldn't do, depending on their congressional opposition, the fact of the matter is we've been on one long-term trend, which is widening inequality and a kind of disdain at the top for those who are caught in the downward sucking sound that that we once heard about from Ross Perot back in 1992.
When you say globalization, do you mean free trade essentially, or what do you mean by it?
So globalization means interconnectedness, but it has lots of different parts and lots of different implications. Trade in goods and services, merchandise trade that you buy an iPhone that was assembled in China. Mm-hmm. That is the kind of baseline. And that usually doesn't hurt too much, but even that can change income distribution. Then there is trade in services, a little bit more complicated because services are more complex in international trade. Then there's trade in capital. That means foreign investment or kind of offshoring of jobs and changing how the value chains of companies mm-hmm. are now distributed around the world. Then there's movement of people. And the movement of people is absolutely by far the most contentious of all of these issues, even though all of them have the implication of changing the distribution of winners and losers. But when it comes to the people, it's you're not just hiring workers, as a recent book puts it. We asked for workers, but we got people instead, mm-hmm. when a book referring to in-migration. It's changing society, and we've had a big change in the composition of society. As I mentioned, the numbers recently.
Is that wrong? Americans were kind of asked to just get over their concern about that. They were told more or less, this is what an interconnected world looks like, and who cares if the color and culture change a little bit? It's going to be great.
I think what is really wrong with that is something that is logically evident, and that very few politicians have been brave enough to face up to, and that is that rich countries like the United States and the countries of Western Europe, and especially the social welfare states that have lots of benefits, whether it's in health or education or family benefits and so forth, would be magnets for not millions but tens or hundreds of millions of people if there are no border controls. And I don't think anybody says that that is feasible for social stability or wise, or maybe a few theorists do. But in principle, people are a bit alarmed at that.
Jeffrey, here's a listener writes this. Let me interject here if I may. One listener writes, globalization has been a big win for developing nations economically and for their citizens' quality of life. Who are we to say that we're the only ones who deserve to prosper?
I agree with that. It's just that, again, within our countries, we should be managing to ensure that we have broad-based benefits as well.
Is there enough profit in a globalized economy for that to work? If you had less concentration at the top, if it was spread around, we had that kind of redistribution, is there enough there to offset everything that's lost when manufacturing goes abroad, et cetera?
That's almost the first principle, by the way, which is that the pie gets bigger, so the winners in principle can compensate the losers. They don't want to, but they can. So I would say that there are the following four issues that I'd put on the table. Mm-hmm. First, within the U.S., we need to take care to have a more, I would call it a social democratic ethos, a sense of fairness, of solidarity, so that there's a sense you're not just left on your own when you lose, but that everybody's part of this. And especially when we have these really egregious, sometimes criminal billionaire winnings, and then people suffering, that's one part of the backlash. Number two is migration. There, I believe, need to be limits on immigration, not to close the borders entirely, but the idea that the borders would be thrown open and we take in, sure, another 100, 200, 300 million people, I don't think is a good idea, nor do I think it's an acceptable idea. Mm. So we have to start with the idea there are limits. They should be enforced. Now, what are they? Let's debate that point rather than calling the opponents of limits xenophobes and racists or believing that there is no conundrum there, because there is. There's a third issue that's very important and is messed up in all of this, which is the refugee issue. Refugees are different from migrants. Mm-hmm. Refugees are people fleeing from war and chaos. Sometimes violence chaos and sometimes environmental chaos. Here's a proposition, Tom, that many people may or may not accept, but the United States has created a lot of the chaos that's causing a lot of the refugee movements. We did it in our own hemisphere, in our Contra wars, in our wars on drugs and other things in our own hemisphere, provoking a lot of this migration, and even more in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, all U.S. wars of choice are the main cause of the mass refugee movements, which is one of the triggers of this whole reaction taking place in Europe. So that's another piece of this puzzle. Stop these ridiculous wars, because they are destabilizing our societies, much less doing incredible damage to the people that are in those countries. And then there's a fourth element that is also a very real one, which is globalization does help developing countries to catch up. I believe in that open world, certainly. I've worked my whole career towards that. But there are many places that are left behind, that are struggling, and some of them have a massive population bulge also. I'm thinking of places in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. And we should be taking a lot more attention to help those places get out of their poverty trap and also achieve what's called the demographic transition, to lower the fertility rates and get the populations more stable. Because if we don't do that 20 or 30 years from now, the pressures we're seeing on migration are going to be an order of magnitude greater. Africa, for example, is on a trajectory right now to go from 1 billion people today, roughly, to about 4 billion people by the end of this century.
Wow.
If one could imagine. Absolutely, in my opinion, population growth out of control. And we need to address that through helping girls stay in school in Africa, getting girls' empowerment, women's empowerment, fertility rates would come down. And if we could only think ahead in our countries, we would recognize that that's part of the long-term building that we want to do. So putting it all together, yes, an open world, but a more solidaristic world where we recognize that we're in this together. We recognize lots of tensions and lots of pressures. We don't go with the elite saying, oh, everything's fine. What's your problem? I'm having a good time. But rather say, we've got to solve problems to make sure that people don't fall off the edge, whether it's the edge within our societies or the edge outside of our societies, and therefore leading to this kind of mass and destabilizing refugee movements and migration that are part of this whole mix.
Boy, the way you describe it, all the things we need to do to create countervailing positives to some of the negatives of globalization seems almost overwhelming. I mean, it leaves me wondering if human ingenuity is up to all that. Let us hold that thought for a minute. Calls for you. Anne in Green Bay, Wisconsin. You're on with Jeffrey Sachs.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just beg to differ with the guest on his point that we shouldn't mock people as racist or xenophobic. I think I'm going to continue to mock them as racist and xenophobic when I'm kind of witnessing people that are falling prey to the propaganda that is of Mein Kampf level. Here in Wisconsin, we are very aware of how effective politicians are at mobilizing people who are hurting and economically disadvantaged to find scapegoat targets. A lot of our Republican governors, we can't ignore them and focus on Obama when we've got so many states in the union that have attacked unions, immigrants, to fuel campaigns that really engage in corporate welfare. So I don't mock the people themselves and the state economic state that they're in, but they are falling prey to propaganda that they're able to legitimize, and racism is part of that.
Jeffrey, what do you say to Anne?
Well, I think, Anne, you and I would agree that people are hurting, and I'm saying that if all you do or if all we do, and I see it every day now on what used to be some of my favorite websites, say Huffington Post, I'll choose one. Okay, every day it's 18 stories mocking Donald Trump, and he said this and he does this and so forth. I actually think this is not too productive, nor do I think it's likely to be very politically successful. It's exactly what happened in the Brexit campaign. Pretty smug, in my view, of just taking the mocking tone. But you and I agree that people are hurting, and that's what we need to be focusing on. I'm happy to call out people who are trying to ruthlessly exploit this, but actually, I'm not a supporter of Donald Trump, let me be clear.
Are you a supporter of Brexit, Jeffrey?
I understand Brexit. I feel bad about Brexit. I'm not a supporter of it. When I hear Donald Trump go and say in the clip that you had, Tom, that the game is rigged and people are furious, I wouldn't mock that statement, actually. That's my point. I would address that statement. Just to call it xenophobic, I think doesn't do justice, actually, to what he is pulling on. Now, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton kind of under a protest flag, I have to say.
After having supported Bernie Sanders rather loudly.
Absolutely. Yep. You know, I'm no fan of hers, but I don't regard Trump as within the realm of anything our country should ever have to deal with as president. But on the other hand, I don't feel that the mockery response is productive because it is a kind of complacency, or it can lead to a different kind of complacency. Look at that idiot. Look at that fool. Doesn't he know that everything is fine? And there is a sense in which she's the status quo candidate. That's why I didn't support her during the primaries, because she really is the status quo candidate. There is a sense in which the Brexit upheaval was partly directed at the City of London, which is, of course, Britain's equivalent of Wall Street. And people in this country are furious at Wall Street. Let me jump into that one also, because they should be furious at Wall Street. It's been almost a criminal organization in certain ways, how many laws they've broken. So there is real anger for real reason.
So
support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the pushback on globalization with big development guru Jeffrey Sachs and more. He's watching Brexit. He's listening to Donald Trump. He's listening to other parties in Europe right now, nationalist parties, a lot of protectionism sentiment out there, saying, wait, listen, there are legitimate complaints here about the way globalization has been implemented. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Have elites turned a blind eye to falling wages of the middle class and more? And what would it take to get globalization right? Jeffrey Sachs has been with us from New York. Jeffrey, stand by. Doug Irwin joins us right now from Hanover, New Hampshire, professor of economics at Dartmouth College. Recently wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine headlined "The Truth About Trade, What Critics Get Wrong About the Global Economy." Doug Irwin, thank you very much for being with us today. Hello, Doug. Are you there? Lost that line to Doug. We'll get him right back. Jeffrey, we've got a lot of callers for you. Let me turn to one. Martine in Miami, Florida. Martine, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome, Tom. Hi, hello, Jeffrey.
Good to meet
both of you. You know, I come from, I was born in Colombia, and my family used to run they developed the coffee business and the textile business, and they used to work with textile manufacturers out of the U.S. And my question to you is, has globalization, in a way, caused the movements of people? Nowadays, I have an uncle who has a factory who used to represent Whitco in the U.S., Whitco in Latin America, and that business dried up, and most of the manufacturing left Colombia. It's actually, obviously, as we all know, globalized, and there's just no money to be made in these countries. They're basically commercialized economies where nothing's being produced.
You mean it's all gone to China or even lower wage places than Colombia, Martine?
Right, right. So people have to find a place to live. They have to go somewhere else to where they can find more opportunities. So isn't it
certainly,
in a way, all interconnected in some way as well?
Certainly the big migration to the United States, it was overwhelmingly a Hispanic migration. The biggest source was Mexico. A lot of it was the Caribbean and Central America. You're from Colombia, a wonderful country, by the way. And a lot of people came out of desperation that they did not have the means of livelihood. Part of that in our more immediate region, the Caribbean Basin, was rapid population growth in Mexico, Central America, Caribbean. Part of it was a lot of violence. Colombia also had a lot of violence, but and also drug-related, gang-related. The U.S. war on drugs, and then the U.S. added to this violence with these Contra wars, absolutely bizarre fighting in the 1980s. And the U.S. did a lot to prevent kind of moderate democratic reformist regimes in the Americas for a 50-year period, a very odd process where the CIA would overthrow almost anybody that tried to make some moderate reforms because United Fruit or others would be on the receiving end of a land reform. And so we contributed to this destabilization.
We get that history. We get it. But speak to this dynamic now. Martina is saying, look, it's hard to put up a factory in Colombia because of the same kind of challenges that American companies face from lower wage and maybe higher manufacturing capacity places like China and beyond. And then how are we surprised when people come north or go somewhere to try and make a living? I mean, is it possible that globalization is just beyond our capacity to manage humanely?
Colombia, to take that example, has just signed last week a peace agreement that for the first time brings peace to Colombia. And I believe it will lead to a huge peace dividend, actually a surge of investment and a surge of business. So we'll see. But my view is, no, it's not beyond us to manage. But what we do have to understand certainly is in a globalized world where China's becoming the biggest single economy, where Asia's becoming the new center of gravity, things will change. Economies will undergo lots of stress, and therefore there will be losers who need the help to find their way. And I don't think it's impossible for us to actually manage and even prosper in such a world, but not through a pure free market approach.
Martin, thanks for your call. Jeffrey, please stand by. Doug Irwin joins us now from Dartmouth College, professor of economics there. Professor Irwin, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
There's been a lot of anti-trade rhetoric. Jeffrey Sachs' critique is something more than that. He's saying he's not anti-globalization, but it's been implemented sort of carelessly with a lot missing in its care for those who get hurt. You have written recently that the anti-trade rhetoric paints a grossly distorted picture of trade's role in the U.S. economy. Trade still benefits the United States, you write, Doug. So what about the kind of critique that Jeffrey's raising?
Actually, as I read his piece and have been listening to him, I agree with just about everything he said. We're very much on the same page. And I think he was absolutely correct to distinguish between different types of globalization or components of it. There's a very big difference between trade and goods and labor migration. Trade and goods is actually reasonably politically popular still in the United States. There are about a third of the electorate who opposed to NAFTA and things of that sort.
Job loss is not popular.
Really labor migration that's been the key issue both in the UK and I think increasingly in the US.
The job loss that comes with that trade has been a pretty sore subject and certainly spoken to by many candidates, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump.
It has been, but once again, if we look at the British vote, that was not about trade. That was more about immigration. They want to keep their market access to Western Europe. And there's an important non-economic cultural component to this fear of immigration. You know, Donald Trump is not saying Mexicans are coming across to take your jobs and we have to ban Muslims because they're an economic threat. He's harking to national security, the identity of the country, safety. He's saying it's criminals and rapists coming from Mexico. And the Muslims, maybe terrorists are getting let in. That's very different than the economic worry that they're driving down wages and taking our jobs.
Jeffrey, is that really where your angle on this comes from? I mean, that's hardly the argument you make. I think you are basing it in an economic challenge.
Doug, ask Doug, if he'd agree on the following. It seems to me we have actually at least three categories that we should discuss. One is trade in goods and services. Second is this phenomenon of offshoring, which is more complicated, whether it's how the value chain now gets distributed globally or typically related to foreign investment that allows a company to divide up its value chain. And the third is the movement of people, migration. And it seems to me that it is right that the ordering is traditional trade in goods and services least controversial, though even there are, of course, income distributional effects and competition from China does directly hit. Second is offshoring. That raises the temperature much, much higher. That's NAFTA complaints. That's the heavy movement of the automotive sector to Mexico and so forth, which in my home state of Michigan is a number one issue. And then third is movement of people, which I think is way off the charts in terms of the public attitude. So I would say three gradations. They all have this element of potentially expanding the size of the pie, even labor migration, because you go from a low wage, low productivity circumstance of the migrant to a much higher productivity circumstance. But they all also have distributional implications. Traditional trade, probably the most modest of them. Offshoring, that's a pretty big hit for certain sectors. And then labor migration is a kind of pervasive view that goes well beyond the economics alone. So I'd ask Doug, would you take those three different dimensions?
Well, I mean, three dimensions. Oh. Yeah, Doug, please.
Absolutely. I agree entirely with that. And I also agree with Jeff that the social safety net has been fractured and frayed, and we haven't invested enough in that. But in terms of the, what do we blame trade agreements or what have you? And this is not directed at Jeff. It's at the more broad debate, you know, we have NAFTA, we have the WTO. That provides a framework for countries to interact in terms of trade. We have no international regime regarding migration. There is no governance structure. We don't really have an immigration policy. We have immigration outcomes. And that's, I think, it's sort of people consider it out of control. There's certainly an economic component, but I think also a cultural, non-economic component to it. And I think that's behind a lot of the worries that we see in Western Europe and the United States.
We've got callers for the two of you. John in St. Thomas in the British Virgin Islands. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is whether or not your guest believes that NAFTA and the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership are a net benefit both for the economies of the member countries and for the people who live in those countries. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Doug?
I think they're both positives for the U.S. economy and for the countries that are partners. In terms of NAFTA, you know, there's been they've had a lot of macroeconomic difficulties, but they've also had a growing middle class, and I think NAFTA has helped that.
Who's they?
TPP in Mexico, mm-hmm. And TPP.
What about the U.S.?
You know, we already have free trade with a lot of those partners. It's countries like Vietnam where we now have an agreement to get their trade barriers down and to rein in their subsidies for state-owned enterprises. So on net, I think it's a plus.
Jeffrey, with your concerns about the way globalization has unfolded, would you see those as net benefits globally and for the United States?
Again, if we focus on NAFTA, for example, the pie was expanded, but there are absolute losers in this, and it's not surprising that they're complaining bitterly because they weren't looked after. That's the politics of this that is serious, because I don't think one can just add up and say, well, it's a net win, too bad for the losers. That's my first point. Second is I've come out against both TPP and TTIP. I know Doug is in favor. This may take us a little bit afar from our current topic, but these trade agreements are really much more than trade agreements. They're about investment. They're about power of corporations. And I view them as unfair in that way, in that they don't embody a social ethos that I find acceptable. And in particular, I'll just give one example. I hope it's not diverting our discussion too much, but there is a dispute settlement clause in all of these agreements, which give a lot of power to companies. And yesterday, or just a few days ago, actually, TransCanada, which wanted to build the Keystone Pipeline and was told no for absolutely legitimate reasons that it's bad for climate change, is now suing the U.S. government under NAFTA to say, how dare you deny us of our profits? You have no right to do that. And they may well win a settlement of maybe $15 billion against the taxpayers out of a rather outrageous clause called ISDS in all of these agreements that basically empower the companies to have more rights than they would ever have in normal courts. And to my mind, without getting into the esoteric parts of this, these agreements do reflect this elite and very lobby-infested bias, which is lots is packed into the fine points of these thousands of pages of chapters, 30 chapters or so. It's all driven by lobbyists. It's all in a context of a political system that is unfair to the working class and the poor. And in this sense, that's where the backlash is coming, that people do not trust the USTR or the president to negotiate on their behalf right now. They just see who's really benefiting from this is at the top, with no interest in our political structure of making sure that the benefits are broadly shared.
Carol in Decatur, Georgia. Carol, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say to Jeffrey Sachs, I wish you would name the elites. It's mainly been Republicans, beginning with the Reagan administration, who have slashed the safety net that we have for the less fortunate. And it's continued with when we have a Republican-dominated Congress. And that's all I wanted to say. It's Republicans. I think a lot of when we have a Democratic president, they really do want to do the right thing.
Carol, thank you for your call. Jeffrey, how about as simple as that? Look at Wall Street.
I wish it were, but it was Bill Clinton that ended welfare as we know it, which did a real job on poor women especially. It was Bill Clinton that liberalized or that deregulated the financial sector, which gave us our 2008 financial bomb in the end. And so I view this not so much in partisan terms, but in a kind of political class terms. I feel that we have two parties that are right of center, basically, in the mainstream. And I don't think they reflect the real interests of the broader class of society. And as I said, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton because I can't stomach the idea of Donald Trump becoming president. But it's a very unhappy vote. And we don't have the kind of politics that really reflects the real interests of our society, I feel.
Doug Irwin, just a minute to go here. Do you see us as being capable of making the kind of significant adjustments and reforms Jeffrey Sachs is talking about without in the reaction to globalization right now, bringing down free trade, bringing down the economy?
Absolutely, because once again, I don't think they're incompatible. And I think Jeff is absolutely right. The usual case for trade is you allow open trade, it creates a bigger pie, but then you have to redistribute income to those who are left behind or hurt. And it's that second part that I think we've been lagging and have suffered. It's interesting, in the 1990s after NAFTA, the U.S. economy was growing at a very robust rate, and we had a lot of dislocation, but those workers were able to find new jobs. Since, 2000 or so, the economy has not been doing as well, and it just exacerbates this problem of economic adjustment, both to trade and to migration.
Jeffrey, do you think that the Brexit leaders are going to bring the new Valhalla to the U.K.? Would Donald Trump bring it to the U.S.?
I hope that everybody takes a new look and says, okay, we better get together and get our act together so that we don't have the kinds of explosions that could really bring the whole thing down.
Looking through the explosion of the Brexit, and who knows what we'll see in this country as our election season unfolds. Great to have both of you with us today. Douglas Irwin, professor of economics at Dartmouth College. Doug, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Jeffrey Sachs at Columbia University. Jeffrey, thanks for coming on today.
Tom, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.